And that's actually what I want to talk about today. When Houston happened, I started thinking about water and oceans and different things about creation, and thought, okay, well, this does tie into the end time, and we're getting close to holy days, so I'm going to try to tie the waters of the earth into the end time, which it does, and we'll see in Revelation. If you could start out in Genesis 1, if you will. Eric did ask for a little bit of additional time, so I cut mine back from an hour or 2 hours to an hour and a half, so we'll be good. If I did that, Nora would come up here and beat me to death, so I know we'll cut it short here. But Genesis 1 and verse 9. It starts out, and God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. Verse 10, "And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good." Now, if you will, go on down to verse 20. Verse 20 said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves. Out of verse 26, God said, "Let us make men in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Now, he does say, "Let us have dominion over the fish of the sea and the creatures of the sea," and all that. It does not say that we have dominion over the sea. God created this earth. This earth's a very powerful, powerful force in the world. So he gives us dominion over the creatures. We do have power. Think about a whale. Think about a shark. What natural enemies do they have other than human beings? They don't have any natural enemies other than human beings. So we do have power and authority over all the creatures of the earth. Now, going to that, we start seeing these hurricanes, the one that hit Houston so hard. We see the devastation in Houston. And we've heard for the last 2 weeks how this is the worst flooding in history, and perhaps. But when we think about floods that have happened around here, didn't we create most of them? You know, I know in this area, anytime we have floods now, they're much worse than they used to be, because what have we done? We've built everywhere. We've filled areas that used to contain overflow. We filled that. We use that for building now. So it's naturally going to flood more. People 150 years ago knew you don't build on the coast, right on the coast, because of storms like this. And yet we do it today. Are these storms bad? Of course they are. But are they the worst in history? I don't know. I think a lot of this is man-made stuff. We have a lot more people that live directly on the coast. As I said, 200 years ago, people knew you don't live that close because things happen. And now it's fun to live right on the ocean. It makes you wonder about that. We don't know what's going to happen in Florida, but we do know that God promises he's not going to destroy this earth with a flood. And we'll go to that later. We do understand that. We know the one coming in Florida. There's one right behind it. Could our feast sites get hit? Absolutely. We're not sure what's going to happen, but we do know that God promises he's not here to destroy us with floods. For myself, there's something calming about walking along the beach. I remember Mr. Dobson. I could relate to him in a lot of ways. I couldn't relate to him on this because he just could not stand being on the beach. He just said, "Oh, I don't even like going near it." But this is the one thing, and I think it's because when I grew up, we went to the feast in Jekyll Island when I was little. And some of my first memories were getting up right at daybreak, and we'd go look for seashells early in the morning. And for some reason, that's always stuck with me. And even today, my kids think that's just stupid sometimes, because I'll still get up and do that, and they just can't relate to that. Why would you get up that early and go do something like that? But it's something that has always stuck with me. And being on the water just has a calming effect for me. But it's not always a calm sea, is it? It's not always calm. I don't know how many have actually been deep sea fishing out where you go beyond the coast and you get sick, but that is the worst feeling I've ever had in my life. There are times when you think, please just let me die, because there's no getting back. There's no instant relief from this, and it is horrible. But the sea can be something that's so unbelievably powerful that it's hard to comprehend for humans, the strength of it. Today, I just wanted to look at a couple of examples of people that have perished in the sea and how that ties into the end time, because it's very specifically mentioned in Revelation about the sea itself. I want to give two different examples of groups of people that perished in the sea, and you see that there were a tremendous amount of people that have died in the sea. First one is something that I have to teach this time of year, every year, and I do not like it whatsoever, because it deals with slavery. And I have to answer a lot of questions that I don't like to answer, and I don't have answers for a lot of times. But in the mid-1500s, we started discovering this, quote, new world, America, the Caribbeans. And they found that crops and sugar mines were even used at that time. But they needed labor. And so they started this, what's called the triangle trade. They would take materials from Europe, cloth, even weapons, take them down to Africa and exchange them for people, for human cargo, and ship them to the Caribbean and to the Americas. And they would supply labor there. They would take the crops that they supplied labor for, deliver it to Europe, and the triangle continued and continued. These people, if you can think of the worst trip you could ever take, I don't think you could picture what these people had to go through. The estimate is up to 11.8 million people taken off the continent of Africa, shipped in little containers no bigger than this, basically this podium, strapped down for 2 to 3 months, feed them just enough to survive, and then take them here, and their whole life was a life of just pure work, day and night. Horrible, horrible life that they went through. Now, we see the 11 million. We hear about the conditions of slavery and stuff, but we forget about something. We forget about 15% of those people were killed in the sea on the way over here, because ships were not sophisticated like they are today. We didn't know technology. You don't even know that these storms are out there. They just go into one and the ship's gone. Over 2.5 million people of this from the African continent just disappeared in the sea. And no trace of them, no real records other than just a ship log that this ship disappeared. We don't know what happened to them. They're just gone. Again, 9 to 11 million arrived here. At least 2 million, I think 2.5, disappeared in the sea. People that we'll never know about, never know their stories. Well, we will someday, but as of now, we do not know anything about them. And when you think about it, God gave us dominion over the sea, and He gave us the sea. What did He give it for? Well, we have food sources from the sea. It's a cleansing agent, certainly salt water. But it's also used for travel, because Paul talks of his travels on the sea. But what was this used for travel? This was an evil purpose in this sense, to take people and turn them into livestock, is what they did here. And we use the sea as an evil tool at that point. So it's good in some ways, but we also use it for bad. Also, I want to talk about another one that's very fascinating for me. And I talked to Mr. Perryman a couple of weeks ago. The USS Indianapolis was just discovered, three weeks ago about, that they actually found the ship. They've been looking for it since World War II, and they actually discovered it. Didn't know that they ever would, because of where it was sunk. But in late July of 1945, the war in Europe was over. Now all I had to deal with were the Japanese. And so the USS Indianapolis left Pearl Harbor. and they were on a secret mission, and they were headed to a small island called Tinian, I think it is. It's a Pacific island, and American B-29 bombers were waiting there. And they were there waiting for this ship because the USS Indianapolis contained parts for the atomic bombs that would be dropped in on Japan. When they finished that job in Tinian, they had 1,197 men on board. And they were sailing toward another small island in the Philippines called perhaps Leyte. I'm not positive about the pronunciation. But they were headed there. And the U.S. government was well aware that there were a lot of Japanese submarines in this area. However, because of the very classified information that they were delivering, or the parts to the bomb, they did not let the ship know that there were subs in the area, and they would not give them an escort. So they headed to the Philippines. They were going to do some training once they dropped the parts off. And they were attacked by a Japanese sub. They were hit at night. And, 300 men? Almost 300 men perished just immediately. They were killed when the torpedo hit. Now, this was a gigantic ship. Would stretch, I don't know, all the way to probably way past Logan's across the street here. And it sank within 12 minutes from just completely disappeared in 12 minutes. But when they hit, most of them were able to get their life vests on. And when it happened, they gathered in a group, tried to take account, and realized that about 900 of them were in the water. And so they were surviving. And they thought, okay, we'll be rescued. They didn't realize that their nightmare just began when this happened. They're in the middle of the South Pacific Sea. You're just as likely to have Japanese come over as you are American ships. So they thought, okay, we're going to get in groups and we'll be fine. We'll get rescued pretty quickly. It took 5 days. 5 days before they were rescued. Now I want to think of the situation they're in. They've got these big, bulky life vests on. They're not like the ones we have today, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. No water, nothing to eat, and the sun beats down in the South Pacific just unmercifully. So you're sitting in the water. If you've ever been in the water, it seems like you get sunburn even worse when you're in the water and the reflection. So these men are floating out there. Some of them go without water and they begin to hallucinate. They start seeing, oh, the ship's right over there. Several of them tried to swim over to the USS Indianapolis. They actually thought it was there. And they would not be seen again. They would either drift off and disappear. Many of them, because they became thirsty, convinced themselves, even though they had had training, that, no, I can drink the water, I'll be fine. Drink the water. You drink salt water when you're dehydrated, it's a death sentence. And they would do that and die. Many of them, because the life vests are only meant to last about 48 hours, would begin to waterlog. And most of them, think how weak you would be after 48 hours. And all you can do is kick and try to stay up and keep your nose above water because of how waterlogged the actual vests were, actually pulling them below the water at this time. These are all horrible conditions, except there was one that was much worse. And that was the sharks that would come in. The sharks decided this was one of the greatest feeding areas that they'd ever seen, and it was for them. The men that survived, and I'll tell you how many did in a few minutes, about just seeing this big flurry of motion in the water, and all of a sudden four or five guys are gone. Just instantly gone. One of the men that wrote a book about it tells about the guy on each side of him. They're floating there and they're kind of in and out of consciousness. And he tried to revive both of them and we flipped him. The bottom half was gone. Both of these men were gone because sharks had gotten him. Many men went insane during this time. You could certainly understand that. They went insane, decided that they wanted to end it, and would pull their life vests off and just float to the bottom. Didn't want to face the shark attacks. Did not want to face the shark attacks. After 5 days, out of the 900 men that were in the water, 317 had lived. 317 men out of the original, you could say 1,200 men, survived. Again, the sea was used for traveling, which I think God did provide it. But what was it used for in this sense? What was the travel? Travel was to kill other men, to destroy each other. We're using what God gave us for something that He certainly did not intend for it to happen. If you could, I'd like you to turn to Genesis 7 now. Look at how God promised He would not destroy it again like this. We all know this story. But it's a story of Noah, and talks about the flood that was on the earth. Genesis 7, verse 4 says, "For after 7 more days I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have ever made. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him." Now, God did indeed destroy the earth with a flood. Man had become so wicked that he chose to start over, and he used this sea, this powerful thing that we see hurtling up toward South Florida right now. He used this to destroy the entire world, water. And let's go to Genesis 9, and this is where, after he established his covenant with Noah, he decided that he would not do this again. Genesis 9, we'll read verses 8 through 11. Genesis 9, verses 8 through 11. It said, "Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." And we're talking about everyone on the face of the earth at this time. "And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth, thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." God does promise not to destroy the entire earth, but He never, in any of these conditions, said the sea would be safe from now on. Oh, you're good to go. I remember I wanted to run triathlons after I quit trying to play volleyball. And I could bike, I could run, I could get all that. And like my wife says, if I get in the water, it's like a rock being thrown in the water. I just go to the bottom. I fought this forever, and I just couldn't get it. So I'm not real comfortable with the water, but a lot of people are. So for me, I'm afraid of the water a little bit just because of that reason. I don't mind swimming, but if I was out in the open ocean, I don't think I would last very long. But God did say He wouldn't destroy the earth, but He didn't promise that it would be safe. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that this year, certainly. About 4,000 people die in the water in the United States every year. That's over 10 people every day that die in the water in the United States every year. The most interesting fact, and I've checked it and thought this cannot be right. More people die sailing than from rugby, soccer, and football combined. I had a hard time believing that would be the most dangerous of all the sports. Downhill skiing did not compare, only climbing mountains that are over, was it 12,000 meters, I think, 10 or 12, but if you get up to 28,000, 27,000 feet, that's the only time when you're more likely to die than you are when you're out in the water. Dangerous place. Beautiful, but dangerous. Here's something that I found. Looked at the, what's it called? The, I don't know, oceanography. I don't know, it's .gov, so it's something from the government. But it gives you a list here of 10 dangers that everyone should watch out for when you're near the ocean. I wasn't aware of a few of these. Rip current. And most everyone hears rip tide, rip current. You get caught in one of those, it can be very dangerous. We took the kids to Destin one year for a volleyball tournament, and we're walking back to the room and saw everyone gathered around a man, and he had been caught in a rip current, and doctors were there, but they could not save him. Very dangerous thing along the coast many times. Second, it mentioned sharks, of course. We do have dominion over them, but when we're in ships, but I don't know that we have dominion when we're in their territory. So sharks are something they also mention. Harmful algae blooms. You see so many people come back with these weird infections and stuff when they've been in the water. Many of them are caused by things like this. So the toxins from these can cause, I'll skip the first couple, vomiting, abdominal cramping, and even death in many cases, including painful skin rashes and skin infections. It does not have to be in the ocean. It can be in lakes anywhere around the world. Seems like we always pick up something when we're on the coast, some kind of weird something we wouldn't get here. Believe it or not, one of the most dangerous things in the entire world is falling coconuts. Doesn't sound possible, but it is a real big problem around the world. I don't know that we face it, but it says right here, a 9-pound coconut dropping 100 feet to the ground, because they are tall trees. Said the blow of that coconut can exceed 1 metric ton when it crushes your head. So I would imagine that would do some damage. So it did mention you've got to be safe. Stay away from the coconut trees. That's what it says. Also another problem, and this is something obviously we've created, unclean water, polluted water. Said anywhere around the ocean, when you get out, you immediately should take a shower, anything like that. It's very, very dangerous because of all the stuff that we put in the water. Sunburn goes without saying that we should do that. Jellyfish. Jellyfish, I don't know how many. If you get stung, yeah, it's a little painful. Won't say what many people say. Hey, this cures it. If you do this, it takes the sting out. But I think most of you know what that is. And also shore breaks. If you're on somewhere like Pensacola, the Panhandle, Panama City, that area, because it's so shallow, when the waves get up, they send you, if you lose your balance, send you into the ground at a much harder rate than deeper areas are. So this is also dangerous. Very beautiful, but very dangerous. Let me see what else is on here. And stingrays. Who's the crocodile hunter? What was his name? Steve Irwin. Killed by something he played with all the time. A stingray that he didn't think would bother him. Killed by it in just a freak accident. So stingrays are very dangerous. Let's see. All right. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians, if you will. Look at, we're not the only people, and the people in the flood are not the only ones that ever faced dangers in the sea. 2 Corinthians 11. I always go to this when I feel sorry for myself and think, oh, woe is me, I've got it rough here. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25, Paul talks about what he had gone through. He said, 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, 3 times I suffered a shipwreck. I don't know that any of us can ever say that. And the next little part says, a day and a night he's been in the deep. So he could relate to these guys from the USS Indianapolis a little bit. I don't imagine they had life vests. So he could relate to what these guys had gone through. It's been throughout time. We don't really have recorded history of how many ships we've lost. But it's been a lot of people that we've lost throughout time. 71% of the earth is covered in water. And when I looked at this, there was this question that says, ask a scientist or something, and it said, how many Why is there more water on the than there is earth, than dry land, I guess the question was. Well, because God said it was that way, and that was it. Well, this guy gave some 40, 50 page on and on and on, and by the end of it, I thought, okay, well, God said, let there be dry land, and there was. So I was thinking about Job. Can you imagine this guy? God says, okay, tell me how the earth was made, and here this guy rambles on with this stuff. I mean, God would shut that down pretty quickly. But when we think about it, Paul had gone through it. People are going through it now. Even at Noah's time, it began. But can you imagine the last thought of all these people? And this is where I wanted to tie it into. A verse that I hate to hear at the feast because it means the feast is kind of over. And I hate to hear it. But can you imagine the last thoughts of all of these people? These poor people who had been taken from Africa, from their family, shackled and going under. What their last thoughts were. The guys that were being eaten by a shark. What their last thoughts on earth were. And how scary it would be to, as we know, when they wake up, what's their first initial thought going to be? You know, there's no hope for a lot of these people until you read Revelation. And that's why I would like to go to Revelation 20 right now. Revelation 20, verses 11 through 13. Kind of a precursor to the last great day, but that's the services that I enjoy the most, the messages usually, because it gives hope to the whole world. Revelation 20, verse 11, said, "Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. And there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. And the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books." And here is where all of these people, whose last moment was a moment of sheer terror, this is when they are awake again. It's fascinating to see what their first thought will be. Verse 13 said, "The sea gave up the dead who were in it. And death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them." So the people on earth that have died these tragic deaths also. What's their first thought going to be? "And they were judged, each one according to his works." So at some point all of these people are going to come out and be alive again. And will be able to experience a life where they won't be in danger of whatever they face there. And I would like to conclude this with Revelation 21. So just turn over a page or two and you think of all of the horrific things that have happened, both on the sea and on land. And again, this is the verse that at the end of the feast, I think, oh, no, the feast is over. We got to go back and fight this world again. But it is one of the most uplifting verses, I think, in the entire Bible. Revelation 21, verse 1. It says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." And notice this. Also, there was no more sea. So it's gone. No more sea on the earth. "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. No more enslaving one another. No more war where people are brutally killed. God himself will be with them and be their God." And this is, I think, for many of us, probably our favorite verse in the Bible. I'd say it'd have to be mine. "And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." That's something we can barely imagine right now. But when you think about it, won't this be a very wonderful time on earth?